Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about some news we didn't get to otherwise this week to end our work week. Let's start the hour with the controversy over gun laws and gun violence. The mass shooting last week at a Florida high school has inspired a growing youth-led protest movement. Classroom walkouts and rallies have been staged in cities across the country, also here in Iowa, with students demanding changes to U.S. gun control legislation. Let's talk with Ryan Westhoff, a sophomore at Cedar Falls High School, which happens to be the high school I attended in the 1980s. Ryan Westhoff, welcome to the program, and go Tigers, I have to say.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
Now, I understand, Ryan, you had a protest that took place there in Cedar Falls, the Cedar Falls area, just this morning.
Yeah, actually, at 10 o'clock this morning, we had a protest at Rob Blum's office in downtown Cedar Falls, calling for him to take action along with our other congressmen, congresswomen from Iowa, to take action on gun control.
Okay, so what does that mean, take action? I don't know specifically what Rod Blum's positions are, but was there anything more specific than take action?
You know, we're not really experts on this, so we don't have a specific policies that we were calling for. We were just calling for some sort of action because there's been a lot of inaction on the congressional level, and every time after we have a tragedy like this, there's some buzz about gun control, but it rarely ever comes through. Just like after the Las Vegas shooting, there was buzz about banning bump stocks, but that never came to fruition after that.
And was there a reaction from Congressman Blum's office that you protested outside of?
Actually, I don't think anyone was inside of Blum's office. So,
all right. So tell us a little bit about the mood at Cedar Falls High these days. Is there anxiety in school when you go every day with all the school shootings around the country?
I wouldn't say there's anxiety, but I would say there's a good bit of frustration about that nothing's really being done about this issue.
Are students talking about, you know, does this sort of put certain students a spotlight on certain students who may have some worrying behavior, isolated students? We're learning this profile that again and again seems to be repeated, isolated students who may be harboring anger, who may be posting threatening messages on social media. Is that discussed among fellow students there?
I wouldn't say that it's discussed that often. There might be whispers about little things like that, but it's not really something like that isn't really discussed. It's more discussed with the fact that the possibility that a student like that could get a gun is more of the issues that is talked about in high schools.
Is there a consensus, do you think, among your classmates about what should be done, or are there differing opinions among your classmates about that?
I would say that there's a consensus that something needs to be done. We disagree a lot on what exactly that there needs to be done. For example, I'd say a majority of us agree that there should be some form of gun control, but there's a group of students that would say that the problem would be school safety and locking schools better, things like that.
Or as the president and the head of the NRA suggested yesterday, the idea proposed that some of the teachers be armed. Is that something you and your classmates would perhaps be welcoming?
I don't think anyone would really be welcoming that, especially teachers. We've talked to a couple teachers about this, and I sensed a lot of fear of having to deal with something like that as a teacher. I think they would rather just be in the classroom teaching than having to deal with a weapon.
Do you have active shooter drills at Cedar Falls High?
Yeah, we do.
What are those like? How often do they happen?
I'd say we have them once or twice a year, about as often as you would have a fire drill or a tornado drill.
And what do you do then in that case?
We practice things like lockdown, and then we practice things like evacuation, run, hide, fight are the three main steps that we have.
Run, hide, fight, and depending on the situation, you choose those.
Yeah, depending on the situation, you use one of those three.
When you have active shooter drills, do you think that do your students and others take that seriously, or do you sometimes tornado drills? I remember certainly from my days in school. Okay, tornado drill, walk out, do this, do that. You know, you can take it more or less seriously. How are students taking these active shooter drills?
I'd say students take the active shooter drills a lot more seriously than they take a fire or tornado drill, because it's just that much scarier of an idea. Because the active shooter, that's deliberately coming for students, and a tornado is just something that happens.
Does having active shooter drills regularly at Cedar Falls High, does that increase or decrease anxiety among students, you think?
I would say it decreases it, because it makes students feel like there's a plan, but it could also cause a false sense of security, because, you know, the way whenever something like that's planned, like they saw what happened at Stoneman Douglas High School, they had a plan, but when things happened, it all kind of fell apart in the heat of the moment.
Mm-hmm. So looking forward now, several days into the aftermath of the Florida shooting, the latest school shooting, what are your hopes for the future and a remedy for the problem of gun violence?
We're just really hoping that something can be done that people can agree upon. It would be some form of reasonable gun control.
Mm-hmm. Are you optimistic that will, in fact, happen?
Yeah, I think that a lot of times in the past there's been calls for gun control, but it feels different this time, because students are actively getting engaged with this, and there's a sense that students are now tired of having to deal with this all of the time. Mm-hmm. So we're finally getting frustrated to the point where we are spurred to action.
I guess the question is, will students like you get tired of protesting, of turning up the pressure on lawmakers and others?
I don't think that'll happen.
No? You think you'll carry on here? There's that much commitment?
Yeah, I think obviously we're committed to being safe in our schools. So whatever it'll take to get to that point, we'll do that.
Okay, Ryan Westhoff, sophomore at Cedar Falls High School, just got back from a protest there in Cedar Falls. Ryan, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you for having me on.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this week, the Associated Press reported that U.S. Congressman Rod Blum of Iowa's 1st District violated House ethics rules by failing to disclose his ownership role in a new company. The AP also reported that the business in question also featured a top federal staffer of the congressman in a false testimonial promoting its services. Joining me now, Ryan Foley of the Associated Press. Hello again, Ryan.
Hello, Ben.
Tell us the story behind this company and Congressman Blum's involvement in it.
Yeah, Tin Moon Corporation was incorporated in May 2016 when Congressman Blum was sort of halfway through his first term in Congress, and it was formed with his – it was the two directors were Congressman Blum and Ed Graham, his longtime business partner, who is the president of Congressman Blum's other company named Digital Canal, based in Dubuque. And this, the Tin Moon is a bit of a mysterious company, but what it seems to do is provide search engine optimization techniques that help companies improve their image online. They basically guarantee we can get you on the front page of search results when people are searching for certain terms.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so explain why this is an ethical violation under U.S. House rules.
Yeah, so every year members of Congress are required to list their assets and they're required to list their outside employment in their personal financial disclosure forms, and the idea of, you know, making sure that they're not using their offices for private gain, that they're not voting on things that could be conflicts of interest, and that they're, you know, there's also strict limits on outside employment and outside income to ensure that, you know, members of Congress are working full-time and don't have conflicts. Congressman Blum did not list that he was a director and the CEO of Tin Moon on his form. He did not list it as an asset. And this only came about really because, you know, we kind of discovered that this was, you know, some of his constituents actually first discovered that this was a company that had been formed and had some online presence. And then there's So Congressman Blum has said that was, you know, an oversight on his part. He's now amended his filing to list it as an asset and to list his corporate role with this company. But there's a lot of other questions that he has not addressed.
Mm-hmm. He, for instance, said, if I'm remembering, and we reported your reporting in our news as well, that, oh, he says, well, this company's not worth anything. It really didn't make any money. Is that seen in the ethical rules of the House as a way to not report it?
No, it's not. Potentially, that would be a way not to report it as an asset if it was worthless. But the rules are very clear that you are required to report all sort of corporate roles you hold. So if he was the CEO, like this website claims, he should have reported that. And it was clear that he was the initial director of this company, and that clearly should have been reported under the rules, and that's what he did report in his amendment this week.
Another interesting feature of this that you reported is that this business in question, Tin Moon, featured a top federal staffer of the congressman, Congressman Blum, in a false testimonial promoting the services of Tin Moon. I want to play a little bit of the audio of this that the audio in question is too long to play the whole thing, and then we'll have you describe what this is.
We're a small company, especially small relative to our competition. Our top competitors were on page one of Google and Bing when prospects were searching for our products. It was obvious that we needed to compete for the sales leads our competition was getting. We thought pay-per-click ad campaigns with Google and Bing were our only option in trying to keep up with our competitors, even though our products are much better. We heard about Tin Moon Labs and their guarantee to get us on page one of the search engines.
Okay, so in the video, you see a man sitting behind the desk. It's not a highly produced video clip or anything like that, but who is this man?
So this is John Ferland, and at the time that was recorded, he was Congressman Blum's district director, and he's since gone on to be Congressman Blum's chief of staff in Washington, D.C. He's posing in that testimonial as a satisfied customer of the congressman's private company, saying that he's representing Digital Canal and that Tin Moon has saved him, you know, his business thousands of dollars. None of that is true. He's never worked for Digital Canal. He hasn't used Tin Moon services. He's actually a federal employee.
Wow. Okay. So has the congressman said anything specifically to that point?
So the congressman has essentially denied all knowledge of some of these problematic details. He says he doesn't know what his staffer was doing in that testimonial. He says he didn't know that the company was using an official congressional photo of him on its website, and that he wasn't the CEO, that he was only the majority shareholder of this company. He also says that he wasn't aware or has no opinion on the company's promise to some customers that it would help them bury their FDA warning letters that they received for when they were cited for food and drug safety violations.
Mm-hmm. Do the facts at all support those assertions?
It's unclear, but it's doubtful. I don't know how he wouldn't know the details of this company when it's run by some of his top political supporters and his longtime business partner, when it's based in, you know, the same office that, you know, his other business is based in.
In Dubuque?
And that it, in Dubuque, and that it features his staffer and his own photo.
You spoke with an expert on house ethics. What did you find out there? And what is the outlook for the congressman on this point?
Yeah, I've spoken to several experts on the house rules who say that what could happen next, it's always hard to predict what Congress is going to do, but he could face a review by the Office of Congressional Ethics, particularly if anyone files a complaint. And given this is an election season, I wouldn't be surprised at all if that happened. He could face some kind of an inquiry from the House Ethics Committee, although now that he's at least amended his filing, that might be less likely. This could get some attention even from, state or federal authorities around, what is really going on here, and is this business making any, problematic misrepresentations.
Right. And everyone knows we have an incredibly partisan atmosphere in our politics at a national level especially. So, I mean, with Congress and the House in GOP hands, I mean, what's the likelihood of real action being taken here?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting. I think it really depends on what the facts show. We don't know a lot of things about, what did he know about all this? What really is going on here? And so I think it'll just depend on, the findings of what any review shows.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, before we say goodbye, how did you discover this lead?
Well, as I mentioned, this was all publicly available on the internet if you knew where to search. And some of Congressman Blum's constituents, kind of my understanding is they stumbled across it when they were actually searching for information related to John Ferland, the man in the video that you played, and they came across this and this business, and then they found that it had been incorporated and it wasn't disclosed. And then, they brought it to my attention, and I investigated further. And, it was pretty eye-opening.
Okay. Ryan Foley reporting this week from the Associated Press on the U.S. Congressman Rod Blum of Iowa's 1st District violating House ethics rules by failing to disclose his ownership role in a new company, Tin Moon, and also that curious add-on there of a top federal staffer of the congressman in a false testimonial promoting the services of Tin Moon. Ryan Foley, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week. Well, let's do a quick check-in with IPR's legislative correspondent, Joyce Russell. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
Let's talk about a few things quickly before we go to our break in the program. We heard your reporting this morning, Republicans, a huge tax cut proposal. Tell us about that.
Well, this is something that has been in the works. Senator Randy Feenstra, he served in the minority for a number of years on the Ways and Means, the Tax Writing Committee. He yearned to head that committee. The Republicans now control the legislature, so he heads that committee. And now he has come out with his very significant tax cut proposal, cut taxes by $1 billion a year, significant reductions in income taxes for both individuals and corporations, a number of other provisions, but a very, very significant tax cut bill.
Right. And for anyone who's been listening to IPR News and your reporting, Joyce, you put that $1 billion tax cut proposal together with the budget cuts, the woes in our budget. How is that justified? What is the thinking of the GOP here?
Well, the GOP majority in Iowa and across the country would argue that lower taxes will help stimulate the economy and in the end will result in more revenue coming into the state. Democrats are very skeptical of that and are, as you just said, very concerned about what that will do for funding essential government services if there's that much tax revenue taken off the table.
Right, and lacking details at this point, I imagine we'll hear those in the days to come.
Right. This is on the fast track, and that was the subject of a lot of the controversy in the debate this week. The bill was introduced one day. The next day, both a subcommittee and a committee hearing on it, they had to suspend the rules for some of that action. And there isn't yet what we call a fiscal note on that bill to really spell out the effect of these various changes on the state treasury. And one way to get around that is you file what's called a study bill. So this was a study bill, and the Fiscal Bureau doesn't put out a fiscal note. I'm using too much jargon here, probably, but they don't put out a fiscal note until it's an actual bill instead of a study bill. So they kind of got around that.
So what I'm getting from you, Joyce, is the Republicans think to fast track this, they have the best chances of getting it through.
Well, possibly, but the House is really taking a much different tack here. The House is going with they're going to be working off the governor's tax cut bill, which is less extensive, does not include corporations, and gets phased in more slowly. So this is not going to be the last word on this by any means.
Okay. Update us on budget cuts being discussed.
Well, as you know, the legislature is in the process of cutting millions of dollars from the state budget in the fiscal year that is rapidly coming to a close. It ends at the end of June. You know, we're at the end of February now. State tax revenue did not come in at the level that the budget was, you know, based on. And so the House and Senate still have not come to an agreement on how to go about cutting that 30-some million dollars out of this year's budget. The House had a hearing on that this week. The most vocal people at that hearing were students from the Regents Universities, from Iowa State and University of Iowa, concerned about the Senate approach to this would cut another $14 million from the Regents' budgets. And the students, of course, are concerned about high tuition the more you cut the Regents' budgets.
Mm-hmm. Joyce, on Monday, we focused on education issues on our Legislative Monday. I understand the proposal to allow kids longer bus rides to save money in school districts has passed.
Well, to pass the Senate, it still has to come before the House. And Ben, that bill has almost a poster child or sort of an icon for the woes about school funding. It came up yesterday in the debate on the tax cut bill. So you'll have Democrats saying, how can we afford these giant tax cuts when we're underfunding our schools and when we're making kids spend all that time on the bus. So that issue has kind of become a symbol out there for budget woes. That bill now goes to the House.
Mm-hmm. Okay. IPR's legislative correspondent Joyce Russell, we'll look forward to Monday with you when we'll talk about judicial funding, courts issues, also a proposal to add the right to bear arms to the Iowa Constitution. Looking forward to Monday. Joyce Russell.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
Coming up in just a minute when we return after a short break on our News Buzz edition of River to River, the controversy over homosexual and transgender content at the Orange City Public Library and the governor's new campaign. It's called If You See Something, Say Something to Report Suspicious Activity. It's your News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week in Northwest Iowa, a controversy erupted over homosexual and transgender content. This at the Orange City Public Library. It's getting lots of media attention. According to the Des Moines Register, here's a little bit of what happened. More than 300 people signing a petition to either ban or label and group materials related to homosexual and transgender content at the library. On Tuesday, a reverend of the Grace Reformed Presbyterian Church rose before a crowd of more than 100 at the Orange City Public Library Board of Trustees meeting and said that LGBTQ books and other library content are, in the words of the reverend, pushing an agenda That is to counter those in the faith community. We won't roll over. The Reverend is quoted as saying, we will stand up, we will fight. Others defended this election, saying that the library is a place of diverse ideas, that library patrons are free to choose what they view or to ignore it. Now, there's some other dimensions to this story. A flyer, for instance, distributed door-to-door through the Orange City neighborhoods last weekend that denounced the materials, along with a petition document and a call to attend Tuesday's board meeting. And the flyer said that the library was distributing, quote, homosexual, transgender-promoting materials, some aimed at pre-K kids, using your tax dollars. Well, let's talk broadly about how public libraries deal with such challenges. Sam Helnick is with us, a Burlington librarian and chair of the Iowa Library Association Intellectual Freedom Committee. Sam, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I gave a short description based on the Des Moines Register reporting. I don't know if you had anything to add to make it more clear to us what happened in Orange City the past few days.
So, yeah, a challenge came to the Intellectual Freedom Committee for the Iowa Library Association from this library to inform us that earlier this month that a petition had gone out, a couple letters to the editor, and just wanted to make sure that they were doing their due diligence for the community and just was looking for some resources to add to the conversation.
Mm-hmm. So public libraries, they deal with these sorts of challenges often?
It happens occasionally. We're starting to see a new trend, though, where it isn't a specific book that is being challenged anymore, where we can look at the text and review it together and have a conversation. We're starting to see across the nation a trend of actual library policies, like this collection development one, or even just entire collections being challenged, which has been an interesting change in events.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so public libraries have resources to turn to in sort of uniformly dealing with such challenges? They have the resources?
Oh, certainly. We have the American Library Association's Office of Intellectual Freedom, who have been very useful to me as the Intellectual Freedom Chair for the Iowa Library Association. Most state and chapter associations will have a committee dedicated to promoting access to information for the community and intellectual pursuits. And then we can always defer to national, and we always collaborate and try to support each other and help contribute to the dialogue.
Okay, so how are these challenges dealt with? What's the process?
Everybody, you know, every library is a reflection of its community, so there are going to be slightly subtle differences in practices, but typically you're going to invite a conversation, fill out a form as a patron in the community if there is a challenge of a program or a collection or a specific title, and that will be reviewed with a library director or a member of staff, and then it may move on to a second tier of board review, a library board, and so then occasionally you'll see the dialogue throughout the community, like we have here in Orange City, where it's on the newspapers, we see a petition happening. But typically, we try to, you know, have that personal conversation once the form's been filled out, and see if we can kind of reach a consensus.
Mm-hmm. And communities vary. They, as you said, public libraries reflect the community in which they are in. So, can you imagine under your rules and in dealing with intellectual freedom that a community would just say we don't want what has been termed here homosexual and transgender content in our library?
Well, I can, just as easily as I can see a lot of LGBTQIA members of that community who also pay taxes saying, oh, I'm so relieved that you have books that represent me and my life experiences here. I think living collections, because that's what libraries are, with databases, classes, and books, we're living, breathing collections that change over time. And if there isn't something here that challenges you, then we might not be doing the best job we can to get you information that you need that you're not used to hearing.
Mm-hmm. There's something I understand called the Library Bill of Rights. Tell us what that is.
So the Library Bill of Rights is really sort of a document which was crafted here in Iowa and then adopted nationally that really lists off the rights that every library user has and our commitment to supporting access to their information so that we have a citizenry that is you know, informed and can assert themselves and their voice in the democratic process of this awesome nation.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us, going back to this case in Orange City, can you tell us the latest on that or how you think this will be resolved?
Well, I know that now that that it's been put out there, they are looking at their policy. The conversation will continue. I think most libraries, public, academic, private, we welcome these conversations. We want an engaged citizenry. But I am really supportive of their policy, which really tries to reflect the reading needs and the intellectual pursuits of everybody in their community. And also it supports caregivers and parents to make those decisions for their own family,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to trying to, you know, solve what might be an issue for this specific group for everybody.
Mm-hmm. This is kind of to be expected, too, isn't it? I mean, our country, in terms of homosexual, LGBTQ issues, has really gone through a very quick transformation in the last few years. So this is not really a surprise, is it, that you would see sort of probably even a generational difference in attitudes about what should be represented in a public library and not?
Well, with the onset of social media and I think profound activism and interest in the community that we are seeing in the last couple of months, so maybe about, you know, year and a half, we're hearing about it more. It's always been here. We've always been pushing for intellectual freedom. I think that's half of what libraries are about, are making sure that you have resources so that you can make informed decisions and that you can commit to the tasks of citizenry and understand what is going on in the world around you and to make it better. But definitely, yeah, I think we'll probably see more of this in the near future, especially since it's easier to talk about with social media. It's easier to be an activist, and it's easier to engage each other in these conversations.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to someone who really is in a community, Orange City or another community, who says, you know, I feel a little bit, to go back to the Reverend's words from Orange City, that they're pushing an agenda, that this is bringing some ideas, promoting some ideas that don't reflect our community here. What do you say to those very real concerns of being sort of besieged by something that they don't see reflects their community?
Well, I can't, you know, speak for that library, but if it were a challenge that I were facing, if I can make it that hypothetical, I would thank them and let them know that I hear them, and then pose the question that if we do remove them, am I actually creating that circumstance for somebody who is represented by that literature? And is it absolutely necessary that we agree with every single tome and dictionary and database and event in the library, or is it more important that everybody has an opportunity to learn and to explore their own life experience through fiction, nonfiction, and hands-on learning experiences? I would suggest that there is a book for every person and for every person a book.
Okay, very good. Sam Helmnick talking about the controversy erupting this week over homosexual and transgender content at the Orange City Public Library in Northwest Iowa. She's a librarian in Burlington, also chair of the Iowa Library Association Intellectual Freedom Committee. Sam, thanks for spending a few minutes with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I hope you have an excellent day.
You too. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, on Monday of this week, Governor Kim Reynolds announced the launch of a new campaign to educate Iowans on the importance of reporting suspicious activity. The Iowa Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management and the Iowa Department of Public Safety are partnering with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to promote the If You See Something, Say Something campaign. It's created to educate the public on the importance of reporting suspicious behavior that could indicate terrorism or a terrorism-related crime. John Benson joins me now, Communications Bureau Chief for Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Hello again, John.
Good afternoon, Ben. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk with you. Describe this new campaign.
Well, what we're doing is we're trying to create that steady drip of information out to the public so they become more familiar with the Say Something campaign. So we want to give the public a level of comfort. So if they do see something that's out of ordinary, you know, that's not part of their everyday process, they see something that kind of gets their, you know, gets them curious. Maybe they've experienced somebody that's made a specific threat, or they've noticed something that maybe a person is starting to stockpile weapons or something like that. We want to make sure that they understand and they're comfortable with reaching out to local law enforcement and letting local law enforcement know about these changes that they've seen. And so law enforcement can investigate it and react if they need to.
Mm-hmm. I think you just alluded to what I was going to ask next is, how much does this have to do with the mass shootings that we've been having?
Well, that's what, certainly one component of what we're concerned with here, but there are also other elements around that. So we kind of, you know, when the process initially started with See Something, Say Something, it was really terrorism-focused, but it also has an effect of, let's take a look at our everyday. So things that, you know, like with the school shootings or maybe some other type of actions taken against other type of facilities, we want to make sure that people, if they do see something like that happening or see kind of those precursor elements being put in place, that they do reach out to local law enforcement so law enforcement can work with them to help address it.
John, give us some examples of things a person might see that raise a red flag that perhaps should be reported.
Okay, well, it's really pretty simple. So, like, if you're looking at a person, maybe you're talking to that person or you're seeing a person that's maybe surveilling an area or looking at a particular building, you know, an individual that you would typically not expect to see there. Maybe you've noticed an individual on social media making specific threats or something along those lines. Also looking at maybe large purchases of things that could maybe be made into explosives or even large purchases of ammunition, things of that nature. And, you know, even like an example at an airport, you'll constantly hear people talking about pay attention to bags. Well, take that out into areas outside of the airport. Are there packages in places where they shouldn't be? Things of that nature. So what we're kind of driving towards is people recognize what is normal in their particular area and looking at those things that aren't normal.
Mm-hmm. When should someone take action? When should someone report something?
Well, that's kind of an interesting question, Ben, and it's up to that individual to make that decision. If by noticing something and their level of discomfort increases and they say, hey, that's something's wrong here, go ahead and reach out to local law enforcement and let local law enforcement kind of take that a little bit further and see if there is actually something there. What we want to have is that level of comfort for that person to make that call and understand that local law enforcement will be there to help them.
Right, but there's always the worry, and I'm sure you run across this too, about people hesitating to report such things because they know they can see something in the neighborhood or wherever that looks suspicious. And then often, you know, it turns out to be something completely well-meaning and innocent, and people are concerned about, you know, turning in people. I mean, should they be?
Well, and that you've hit upon kind of the challenge that you have with it, specifically for people, general citizens that are out there, is that kind of, well, maybe this person I'm seeing is actually just, you know, not doing anything harmful. How do I make that decision? I guess my guidance on this would be is that if it causes a level of discomfort for you as an individual where you say, I just don't think that's right, then go ahead and make that call and let law enforcement work the issue. Best case scenario is that you are wrong and there is nothing actually happening there. The next kind of best case scenario is there is actually something happening and you've taken the step to stop it.
Mm-hmm. What should you take note of if you see something suspicious? What in particular will the authorities be interested in knowing?
Well, some of the things they're going to be interested in, say if it involves a vehicle, a description of the vehicle, even license plates, if you're able to come up with that. If it's an individual, you're talking about the physical characteristics of that person and what type of actions they were undertaking. And then, you know, obviously a description of the type of activity that you're seeing. And if you did have interaction with the individual, you know, even like via Facebook or other social media outlets, what type of statements were being made and where did the location of the encounter happen? You know, just kind of those real simple who, what's, where, when, why, and how that we're all familiar with, just kind of applying those to that situation.
Let's just say I see a suspicious truck or something with a suspicious carload there. Should I take action myself? So, for instance, pull out my smartphone and take a photo?
Well, you certainly can. And one of the things that you could obviously do would be to reach back to local law enforcement. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with reaching out to them and saying, hey, I noticed this truck. Here's the description of it. This is the reason why it kind of caught my eye. I'm not sure if it is something to be that would be of suspicious activity, but it's something I have noticed that's not normal for what is normally around here. I want to make you aware of it. not sure one way or the other, but I want to make you guys aware of it. So you as local law enforcement might need to take some action on that.
Should I ever, in this situation that I put forward, approach the driver, ask him about it? Should I take further action?
No, absolutely not. That's the job of local law enforcement. And I think if you were to talk to any, like, police or sheriff's officers, they would all say that just make that contact to them. Don't do anything else. Let them work the issues as the trained professionals that they are. That's going to be the best option. We don't want to put any citizens in harm's way in any way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm. You said this is sort of a follow-up to, you know, what we've had in our culture since 9/11, you know, trying to head off terrorism and terrorism-related crime before it happens. As far as the type of people, do you look at that at all? I mean, when we hear terrorism, we hear about you know, foreign terrorists, at least as reported often in the media. But this can be a person who looks white, dark, anywhere in between, right?
Yeah, we're not necessarily interested in the physical characteristics of the individual. We're interested in the activity that the individual is undertaking. And as you've correctly noted, Ben, I don't think there's really a definition of person A that looks this way is going to be a terrorist, person B that looks this way is not. It's truly the activity that the individual is undertaking and what are those actions and how do those actions play forward. So that's what we're truly interested in, is the activity.
Okay. John Benson, Communications Bureau Chief for Iowa Homeland Security and Emergency Management, talking about the launch of a new campaign to educate Iowans on the importance of reporting suspicious activity. The campaign is called If You See Something, Say Something. And, John, when you do say something, is it your local authority? Give them a ring. That's the best avenue?
Yep. If you know their administrative number, feel free to give them a call there. If you don't know that number, the easiest way to do it is going to be to call 911.
And John, there's a website people can contact as well, right, to report anything?
Sure. It's saysomething.iowa.gov. And when you get there, it's going to link to some of our partners at the federal level, at the local level. So it kind of becomes a one-stop shop for people interested in learning more about the process and the program.
Okay. saysomething.iowa.gov, the website, also to report things. John Benson, thanks.
Thank you, Ben.
Finally, today on this News Buzz edition of our program, we're going to groove into the weekend with Mark Simmet of IPR's Studio One. Mark, how you doing?
Good. Good to be here, Ben.
So what do you have for me as a news junkie and other news junkies to ease our minds into the week, groove us into the weekend, Mark?
Well, as we're getting this segment started, it's interesting that it just happens to be somebody that might not be all that relaxing to listen to, a guitarist named Ty Siegel. And his new album, Freedom's Goblin, is our featured release this week.
Okay, let's listen to a little bit of Ty Siegel. Sounds great. Not entirely relaxing, as you said, Mark, but, you know, get some energy going there. What other releases have Studio One listeners been able to enjoy?
You know, this time of the year, we're starting to ramp up again as we head towards springtime. A lot of this has to do with colleges and how they work with semesters and so on. So we've got some big releases out right now. Belle and Sebastian, the Scottish band, have a new album. MGMT. Recent performers at the 8035 Festival have a new album, raising a lot of excitement. The Decemberists also played at 8035. They've got a new one coming out shortly. And, you know, a lot of these bands, it's, you know, I don't know if your listeners, I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with these bands, but it's kind of in the non-commercial college radio world,
right,
that these are the big names. Whereas, you know, top 40 radio, not so much.
Right. Hey, and this talk of your listeners and our listeners, they're our listeners. We are Iowa Public Radio. Mark Simmet, thanks for...
That's true, but we're at opposite ends of the day, Ben.
That's right, we are. We serve different purposes, you could say. Mark Simmet of Iowa Public Radio Studio One, Gas Money and Studio One's tracks. Thanks, Mark, for grooving us into the weekend.
My pleasure, Ben.
Music of Ty Siegel as we groove on into the weekend. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Natalia Reyes. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. See you on Monday.